A pleasant good morning to everyone. Nice to see some of our travelers back with us and some faces we may not have seen in just recent weeks, but I know some of that's due to some colds that have made their way around our families. Hope you all are in good spirits today and able to enjoy the Sabbath and the beautiful day that it is. You know, some days everything goes right. You thought I was going to say everything was going to go wrong, didn't you? But anyway, I'm going to get to that in a moment. Some days, everything can go just the way you want it to. And yes, some days everything will go wrong. But there are those days, every now and then, oh, you wake up and you feel rested. You wake up to a day of sunshine and blue skies. You get up, go to the closet, and there's a freshly clean shirt there for you to put on. I'm talking about the men now. And you're appreciative of that. And you get up and you have a hearty breakfast. Your wife gives you a kiss when you come into the kitchen. And boy, there's a smell of fresh bread cooking. And you wonder what's going on all day long. And you get in your car and the car starts. And, you know, and it sounds good. And you pull out the driveway and head on to work. You catch every single light on the way to work. Not one light holds you up. You just sort of go along. You go with the flow of the traffic. No problem at all. No one honks at you. No one does any obscene scene. Nobody cuts in front of you to upset you. And you arrive to work, and there, right in front of the building closest to the door, is a parking spot. And you say, my, my, this is a good day, isn't it? You go inside, you walk in, and the receptionist is real friendly, smiles at you and says, well, hey, how are you doing? Really nice to see you today. Everything okay at the house? And so forth and so on. You go down the corridors of the hallway. Everybody smiles at you and, you know, maybe pat you on your back. Good to see you. Boy, it's nice to see you. You get inside your office and you're paged by the boss. The boss says, well, hey, I'd like you to come in and I've got some good news for you. I've been listening to your suggestions, and you know, out of all the suggestions that have been offered, yours is the very best. And I just wanted you to know that. It's going to make a big difference in our sales here. So as a result of that, I'd like to give to you and your wife a 5-day paid vacation to the Caribbean. Now, some days, everything just seems to go right. Boy, you sort of perk up. Great day with your colleagues at the office. The day whisks by. In fact, you get to go home a little bit early and you beat all the traffic rush to get back home. You're taking off your clothes and lo and behold, you reach in here and pull out something, feel something in your pocket, don't really know what it is, and pull it out. And it's a $20 bill that you didn't even know that you had. And there's a $20 bill, and you take that and you put it in your pocket. You head into the dining room, and there's an exceptionally tasty meal that your wife's prepared for you. It smells wonderful, tastes good. You notice your wife is particularly cuddly that evening as well, you know. And this, your kids actually come to you and ask you for some advice. And they tell you they're going to do what you suggest. Well, this is quite a day. You proceed along and you fall into bed a little bit early that evening after having just caught a little bit of the news, and it was all good news that you heard that evening. You go to bed, you fall asleep quickly, realizing that you are truly a blessed and upstanding human being who is worthy of praise. All right? And on the other hand, there are those days that dawn in gloom and end in disaster. You get up all right and you sort of put on a shirt that looks like it needs to be re-dry cleaned. You work your way into the kitchen and you sort of fumble in the darkness of the night because no one's up yet. You're the first one up and the coffee's ready. You spill the hot coffee on yourself and you don't have time to take the shirt off. You sort of cover it up with your jacket. You get in the car. Car refuses to start. And here you are inside your garage. And you notice that there's some wire missing somewhere and you can't even get the garage door open. So you're a captive in your own home. You work things out. You finally get the door open. You manually take care of it. You get your neighbor next door to jump start you, and he's not very excited about that, but you manage to get that old rackety car started. You get to work, you walk in, it's like you don't even exist. Co-workers don't even look up from their work. No smiles, no pats on the back, nothing like that. You walk down the corridors and you sit in your desk. The bank calls you in, your boss calls you in this time, and he says, I've got some things to talk to you about. I notice that your sales are lagging just a little bit. Meanwhile, there's an interruption on the intercom, and inadvertently the receptionist says, your banker is calling, and you get on the phone and you notice that, unfortunately, you are overdrawn in your checking account again. Well, you're having quite a day. Well, because you are late to work, because you were caught up in the traffic jams and jumping your car and so forth and so on, you're asked to stay over. So you end up driving home in the tail end of the rush that proceeded earlier in the day. So you get home, you're a little bit harried, a little bit frustrated, a little bit short on the temper. You walk in the door, and your wife is a little bit upset about all that she's had to deal with that day. And above all things, you are late, so the dishes are all up, and all there is on the table is a cold pizza. Everyone at the house is fighting, and then all of the things you learn, the dog's missing. Somebody left the latch up on the fence, the dog's out running in the neighborhood, and you got half your neighbors scared to death because you have a pit bull. Well, when it's finally all said and done and you're able to collapse into bed that evening just a little bit late after watching the news, and it was all bad news on the news that night, you lay awake unable to sleep. You have to get up and take a sleeping pill or two, get up and go to the bathroom several times through the night. You don't rest well at all, and all of a sudden it dawns on you that you are truly cursed, you are wretched, and you are a worthless human being, and that you are fit for the dung heap. Now, of course, nearly all of our days fall somewhere in between those two extremes, thankfully. However, we must recognize that a steady diet of the one or of the other would succeed in making us either insufferably arrogant or deeply depressed. A Jewish theologian came up with an interesting thought, which I want to use as the springboard for the sermon today. He raised the possibility that our spiritual natures are very, very closely attuned to a concept he called two pockets. Now, we all have pockets here today. Have you ever reached into a pocket and found something that you didn't know that you had left there? Have you ever done that? I know I did it just the other day. I had a pair of jeans, and I was picking the jeans up. I was going to, you know, hang them up, and I held them upside down, and all of a sudden, it wasn't a $20 bill, but a penny fell out of my jeans. And I thought, well, how'd that penny get in there? Now, here's another item I leave in my jeans or my suit a lot. It's this little bottle of oil right here. It's pretty small, and I guess I just tend to ignore it because I put one in the left pocket and the other one, my keys, I always get those in my right pocket. But every once in a while, I'll put on my clothes, and guess what I'll find? Didn't know in my left pocket was a... Well, there it is. I've been wondering where that was. Well, you know, we didn't lose it after all. This Jewish theologian brought out the possibility, and it's just an initial observation, something to consider, that life is pretty much like having two pockets that we draw out of each day. In one, you make it whichever pocket you want to, we have a pocket full of, we are nothing but dust and ashes. But when you reach into the other pocket, still the same pair of trousers, the same shirt, same jacket, but in the other pocket is the principle that it is for our sake that the universe was created. One is a contrite, humble approach to the day. The other one is, well, hey, we're worthy of God's greatest blessings. And like I said, if you're not careful, one will leave us insufferably arrogant, and the other one will leave us very depressed. So somewhere in through there is where most of us fall. But you know, there's a lesson here that we need to learn from that Jesus Christ used to teach us about the way that we ought to be. So I want you to consider which pocket you draw out of as one of God's children when you begin your day. And I concede that it's probably a mixture. I want you to come over to a very familiar parable. It's in Luke 18. This is the parable that involves the Pharisee and the tax collector. I have looked at this many times, and there's lots of things to consider here, and I'd like to bring out a few things that you perhaps have not heard before. There is one thing that we must establish, though, as we begin, and it's simply this, that you and I today look back at this parable through the window of careful examination. How many sermons have been preached on this? These two men, these two people, which are really caricatures? Jesus uses them as an example of extremes. I preached, I don't know how many number of sermons about it. I preach about it during the Days of Unleavened Bread and the Passover, about this is the way we ought to be, this is the way we ought not to be. But we look back and have filtered that through the centuries that have passed since it was given. We must, to really learn from it, consider how it was viewed when Jesus gave it. Because the way in which it was viewed when Jesus gave it is not the way in which we view it today. I'll explain that to you. Let's read through it so you see it in its full context. Luke 18, over in verse 9. Jesus spoke this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and that they despised others. Now, right there you will notice that Luke tells us specifically to whom this is directed. So we know the object of this parable, who Jesus is directing it to. So we are early on then introduced to two characters, this Pharisee and this publican. But again, I want to mention, to those which trusted in themselves that they were righteous and they despised others. Now let me just read through this. We'll come back to explore it just a little bit. Two men went up into the temple to pray. The one was a Pharisee, the other was a publican. A publican is a tax collector. You know, we've been talking a lot about that lately, about Zacchaeus, but here's another one. And there's probably a reason why Jesus uses publicans a lot, several times in his expositions, because of the way in which they were perceived then. All right, a Pharisee and a publican. The Pharisee stood up and prayed thus with himself, and he says, God, I thank you that I'm not as other men are, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican. Uh-oh, there we reach into that pocket. Oh, look how great I am. That's the life's pocket that he reached into that day. Look at what I have done. Look at all my works. Look at all my accomplishments. And I'm not even as this old publican back here in the back. We'll see in just a minute. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And then verse 13, the publican, that tax collector, standing afar off, he would not so much as even lift up his eyes to heaven, but smote unto his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I'm going to stop right there. In the day and time that that was presented, who would have been perceived to be the most righteous? Who were you supposed to be like? You were supposed to be, the listening audience thought that if you're going to be like anybody, you better be like the publican, the Pharisee, because he was righteous. You know, this is this old, dirty, rotten tax collector over here, and you'll see his attitude. What's he doing? He's smoting himself on his breast, and I think there's a reason for that. Wonder why he's smoting himself on his breast. Some commentators bring out that beneath the breast is the heart. You know, that's what's below there, and he's, if you will, he's striking his heart. He's of a contrite spirit. He's of a broken heart. All right, that's what you see there in that particular example. But what about this Pharisee and this publican? I suggest that from our 21st century perspective that we don't really see it as it was viewed at that time. I'll tell you how I see it now. I see the Pharisee's behavior as obnoxious and arrogant, insufferable. Don't you? Have you ever known anybody like the Pharisee? Yeah. Never. Only every time I look in the mirror. certain aspects of that come across, you know, because we get a little bit on our high horse. That's what we call it today. We ride on a high horse. I know of people like that, and they talk about this and that and the other thing, and they become special. You know, I sort of have a little bit of an axe to grind about being special. You know, you come up here with a gift of healing, I'll say you're special. You come up here with a gift of prophecy, I will say you are special. Of course, I do believe that anybody who is converted and really trying their best is special in the sense that they are God's child. But, you know, some people just call on being special because they're too arrogant. They just want you to believe they're special. But anyway, that's another subject for another time. No, I've known people like the Pharisee, and they are obnoxious, and they are insufferable today. But back then, it was not received quite like it is today. Now, I want you to see a couple things here. We read through it. You notice that his prayer is like a list of his good works, his own self-praise. You notice that? Let me come back here to verse 11. The Pharisee stood and he prayed thus with himself. Raises the question whether or not God is really listening. He said, God, I thank you. And so his only appreciative thought, what he is thanking God for, is not God's blessings, not the food, not the rain, not the healings, not the family relationship, not the knowledge. I thank you that I'm not like anybody else. I'm really elite. You know, I'm really special. See, I stand alone. You know, I thank you that you have brought me to this stage. I'm not like these other men out there, these extortioners, these thieves. I'm not like a thief, and I'm not an unjust person. I'm like not out of control rogue. I'm not a violent individual. I'm not an adulterer, and of course, I'm really not like this tax collector back here. I mean, this guy is the scourge of society. See, I'm not like him at all. Then we have a list of a couple of little works that made him special. He said, I fast twice in the week, and of course, any of you who've done a little bit of studying on this, you realize at the time the Jewish requirement was that he only fasted, you know, that's the way they did it back then, that if you really wanted to be righteous, you just had to fast one day a week. Well, how many days a week did he fast? Twice. I mean, he was very righteous, see. He was more righteous than the guys who were just doing it one day a week. And of course, I give tithes of all that I possess. So he was able to compliment himself in that particular fast. A Pharisee, standing there praying to himself. It reminded me of a story. I hope Benny doesn't mind me telling this. It's one of the most humorous things I can visualize, and yet it's true. Benny has shared with some of us in the office an experience he had one time in prayer. Because, you know, one of the times that Pharisaicalism, if you will, or piety, false piety, comes out is in prayer. Have you ever listened to people who pray, and they're just praying to hear themselves, or putting on a show and a demonstration, and I don't know what they're trying to accomplish. I mean, they couldn't do all this, that, and the other rigmarole. And I really think that they're doing just like it says here. They're just giving thanks for who they are, and they're trying to make a big show. Well, Benny has told the story, and it's a little bit humbling when you realize the intent behind this. But Benny has told that one time, that was some time ago, because of circumstances, and I won't give all the details, but he was involved in prayer with a minister of the church. And Benny had invited the minister of the church over to his home. Okay, no problems yet. That's the right thing to do. And of course, Benny was at home, and he didn't feel any need to put on a suit and to be all dressed up. But the minister they invited to his home, I guess being ministerial, felt he had to put on the suit and the tie, even though they were pretty good friends. Okay? But these perceptions and ideas that you get. So Benny was waiting, and The minister came over and invited him in. Benny noticed that when he got out of his vehicle, he got up and adjusted his suit, you know, sort of made sure everything was in place and had to look just right, and had his suit on. Came into the house, and they were going to have a discussion, so they wanted to open with prayer. No problems yet, right? That sounds good to me. Prayer is a wonderful tool. Ought to do that. But one of the things you don't know is that Benny has a little dog named Lucy. It's a little dachshund. Lucy stands only about that high, probably about this long. And Lucy and Benny are buds. All right, you know what I mean? But they're close. And Lucy is also very close to Nora as well. And since Benny and Nora's kids have left, Lucy has sort of become their adopted kid. You know what I'm saying by that? Just close to their dog. And so anyway, they decide to start the meeting with prayer. And I got to thinking about this because, you know, some people think that the world revolves around them. And I think that tends to be the plight of a Pharisee, this one right here. The world revolves around me. Everything I do and say, well, that's what God sees. All right. So they were going to have prayer, so they knelt down in Benny's living room in prayer. And as they're kneeling there, Benny's told the story sometime, you know, kneeling in prayer, and the minister started open with prayer. Do you mind if I pray before we talk? Well, sure. So they're all kneeling there, and Benny happened to notice out of the corner of his eye, opened his eyes, that Lucy was there. And Lucy was like this, praying too. In other words, you know, I mean, standing up on her hind legs and looked like she was praying, you know, a little pause just like this. And so they were all there, and sort of a funny thing to imagine, here are two men on their knees in Benny's living room praying, and the dog is in the circle like this, you know. And I'll give you the rest of the story in a minute. So anyway, prayer goes on, and it went a little bit lengthy, as Benny has told the story, and that's fine. No, nothing wrong with lengthy prayer, especially in private like that. But then Benny thought, once the prayer was over by the minister, had been offered by the minister was going to get up. And so Benny is still kneeling there, And the gentleman's standing up, and Benny grabs him by his jacket, by the bottom of his jacket, and tugs on it. And said, looks at, and Benny's looking up, and he says, "Do you mind if I pray too?" Oh, sure. I'll pray too. So they kneel back down. Of course, here's Lucy. So Benny offered an appropriate prayer as well. And yet, after it was all said and done, Benny, I think, made an interesting comment, because you'd have to know all that was being involved in this. But after all the prayers had been said and the weeks and months and so forth had gone by, Benny observed that probably the only one whose prayers got through were Lucy's. Lucy's prayers got through because whatever they prayed for didn't turn out. And I thought about that because, in a sense, there's just a tinge and a tone of self-righteousness and all that, isn't there? In the way in which it was done. Well, I'm the minister. I'll make the prayer. I'm close to God, and, you know, God will listen to me. Okay, well, Benny thought, well, wait a minute. Can't God listen to me? And, of course, Lucy's there. Well, somebody listen to me as well. I can see then that we can perceive that, hey, part of this problem with the Pharisee is that the pocket that he had reached into that day was not really very deep at all. It was mired in his own self-worth. Well, what about this lowlife back here, this publican, this tax collector? We have to consider him for just a moment. I also read something I thought was quite humorous. I guess this was a trait back in college. Betsy and I were talking about something driving to church here this morning about our particular habits. Betsy and I do that fairly frequently, about you're this way and I'm that way, so we sort of understand each other and know how to work and complete each other's responsibilities in the home. But, in the college days, especially for men, they had a particular trait. I don't know if any of you knew this or not, any of you have been to college and done this, but a man was telling about his daughter and her date. And I guess they had been to church, all dressed up in their suits and all that, and the guy looked pretty good. His daughter looked great. So they came back from church and got into the house, and the gentleman said, the father said, "Well, listen, I think I'll take my jacket off. Why don't you take your jacket off, too, and relax and be comfortable?" And the young man sort of began to hem-haw around and got uncomfortable. He said, "Well, I really don't prefer, if you don't mind." And he asked the father, he said, "Can I talk to you for just a minute?" So he got the father aside, and he said, "Listen," he said, "I don't mean to cause any problem," he says, "but I'm a college student, and I do, like so many college students, the only part of my shirt that's ironed are the collars and the cuffs." And so, and it looked like it had been ironed with a weed eater, the rest of the shirt. The only part that was ironed was the collar and the cuffs. So he looked great. And is that not a little bit the way the Pharisees were? What you saw looked pretty good, but what was underneath, and ever so close, was in fact atrocious. Now let's consider this example of the the publican here, and he's standing afar off. Now I do want you to see here, I think that Jesus uses these as a contrast, and I'm going to step out on a little bit of, I hope not too sensitive, but just something for you to think about, because I'm not sure that Jesus wants to be exactly like this publican either. Exactly, I use the word exactly. If I'm going to favor one or the other, I know which one to favor, because I'll see that in a moment. But what I see with this is, I see a person here who is, yes, humble, no problem with that, but I don't see any prescription for coming out of his sin. He just says, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." I've known people who don't move beyond their sin. They stay depressed. They have no self-worth. They don't have any get up and go. They think God hates them. They live in fear. And so I see this exactly for what it is. I think it is an example that illustrates an extreme between being this way, one way too far, and the other way as the extreme, to get our attention. Okay? Now, I wonder why it is that the Pharisees and Jesus probably butted heads often like they did. Because like I told you, if you'd have lived back then in their day and age, the one you wanted to be like was not the publican. You wanted to be like the Pharisee, this righteous man. And it's probably because the Pharisees were mired in the minutia of the law, of the Torah. They wanted to keep it right down to the jot and the tittle. and it was exclusive. There was not any room in their community for the quote-unquote sinner. You follow me? The pagan, the Gentile. There wasn't any room in their spiritual community, in that pocket, if you will, for people who were sinners. Jesus came and showed them that the exact opposite was true, and that the minutia of the law was not restricted to them. In fact, he showed them that, hey, let's not get lost in the law, and let's open our community to the sinner. You may not be aware of this, but one of the reasons why the Pharisees were the way they were is revealed here in the first psalm. If you'll turn there, hold your place in Luke 18, because we're going to come back there in a little bit, in the first psalm. It's a very short psalm, and this is pretty much the reason why the Pharisees were the way they were, and they wanted to pull away from the rest of the community. Verse 1, blessed is the man that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scorner. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law does he meditate day and night. And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth his fruit in his season. His leaf also shall not wither, and whatsoever he does shall prosper. Then it says in verse 4, the ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. So you see, let's separate ourselves from those sinners. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, parentheses only, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. When we look at this and understand it, we will note that Jesus came and made his truth and his sacrifice available to all mankind, sinners and righteous alike. Jesus welcomed sinners. He did not trash people. He did not trash people. But he did condemn their sins. And that's a big lesson for us. You know, it's too easy to sort of trash people. And there's nothing to be gained in that. You know, it's okay to condemn sin. But let's realize those people are welcome in the community of faith as well, just as long as they're not actively practicing their sins in our number and in our midst. There's some historical roots behind Luke 18 and the prayer that was offered by the Pharisee, and also the attitude of the publican. I'd like for you to notice this, because let me ask you something. We basically come to things because we learn to do it. Now my question to you today is, how did this Pharisee come to learn to pray like that? Think about that for a moment. Where did he learn that? I stuff. Okay. Well, probably, I'll put that in quotes, it could come from Deuteronomy, if you'll turn there with me, Deuteronomy chapter 26. Because we notice, if we read Luke 18, while you're turning back to Deuteronomy 26, I want to bring something to your attention. Two men go up into the temple to pray. All right. Now, let's come back to Deuteronomy chapter 26, and I want you to see an act of worship that is revealed here. Deuteronomy chapter 26 and beginning in verse 1, it shall be when you are come in the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance and possess it and dwell therein, that you shall take of the first of all the fruit of the earth. This is called the offering of the first fruits. Years ago in the church we used to practice this. It was a tradition in the church. It was not a law. It was just a privilege. I used to practice it myself, and also I have to confess I was on the other end of the receiving of the first fruits. Especially back in the early 70s up in Michigan, they had these cherry trees in Michigan and the beautiful strawberries that they would raise in the spring. And I remember going to church on many occasions, and there would be just a little basket of first fruits. It says first fruits for the minister. I'm only saying that because I'd like to start that tradition again. But it was a lot of fun, and we would go down the highway and enjoy that little bit of little basket, the first of the first fruit, first of the fruit that bore on a tree. And in all honesty, there have been some of our number who have practiced that in our community. For example, in our gardens that we grow around here, I've had people come up with a little handful of onions, you know, and offer that's the first of their first fruit. And those are the ones I give pass along to Bronson. No, actually, you know, you keep them, but, you know, I think that's a good practice, and, I mean, it's a little tradition, I don't mean to divert too far, but certainly if you were going to do that, what would be wrong with doing something like that and giving it to the widows in the church? You know what I'm saying? Those who are all locked up in a, not locked up, but, you know, confined to their homes and can't really get out and around. Why not, if you have a little bit of first fruit, just a little principle here to share with them? Well, anyway, that's another subject. This is the giving of the first fruits, and I want you to notice how it's done. Which you shall bring of your land that the Lord your God gives you, and you shall put it in a basket, and shall go unto the place where the Lord your God shall choose to place his name there. And you shall go unto the priest that shall be in those days, and this is what you're supposed to say. What are you supposed to say? I profess this day. I emphasize that. I don't think he would have said it that way. But who's he talking about? He says, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God that I am come unto the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers for to give us. In other words, the emphasis here, look what's happened to me. And I see something else in here, you know. God wanted the giver, the donator, to identify himself. I did this. And I profess this day unto the Lord your God that I am come, and so forth in verse 3. The priest then in verse 4 shall take the basket out of your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God, and you shall speak and say before the Lord your God, a Syrian, and this refers to Jacob if you're a student of Old Testament history. The reason for this is, referring to Jacob, is because of his lengthy stay with his father-in-law Laban in Syria. He was there for quite a while. It's sort of like me. I'm from Indiana, but people would know me as a Texan because I've spent so much of my life in Texan. So this Texan, no, I'm not really a Texan, but, you know, I'm called a Texan because I've lived here for so long. So Jacob was called a Syrian. Ready to perish was my father. He went down into Egypt and sojourned there with a few and became there a nation, great, mighty, and populous. And it goes through this story that we're all familiar with about the Egyptians and how the children of Israel were delivered from that bondage. God brought us out, verse 8, and he has brought us unto this place, verse 9, and has given us this land, even a land that flows with milk and honey. Now, verse 10. And now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land, which you, O Lord, have given me, and you shall set it before the Lord your God, and worship before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Lord your God has given you, and in your house, you and the Levite and the stranger that is among you. The reason I ask you to turn back there is I think that this is probably, at least, a contribution to why this Pharisee was talking about I. And here he is in prayer talking about I. Okay. We learn later on, you know, human beings abuse things. Don't they just abuse things? Okay, so Jesus then had to say, okay, what? Listen, we've had enough of this I stuff. Not that it's wrong to use I, but you know, in the model prayer in Matthew chapter 6, he took it from a completely different viewpoint. But I suggest to you that there are those occasions when you enter into prayer before God on your knees, which more effectiveness than Lucy, and it's okay to identify yourself and to talk to God about yourself and to bring your prayers before the throne of God. You know. Years ago, as a student of Baptist College, we were critiqued on how many times we said the word I. You remember those days? Afterwards, they'd evaluate you. Say, well, you talk to you know, it's your icebreaker, see? It's your icebreaker, which is the subject of your life. You're not supposed to talk about yourself. I've always wondered, how in the world is that supposed to be done? You know, you're given an icebreaker about your life, and they critique you for using the word I. Well, anyway, I don't know. Some of those things, those are the good old days. The Pharisee then lists all these things, as we mentioned in verse 12, much like the example there in Deuteronomy chapter 26. Now, let's come back to Luke 18. And let's take a little bit more of an extensive look at the attitude of the publican, this tax collector. And while you're turning there, I want you to come back to consider life's two pockets. And I want you to consider, you know, what it is that we choose to enjoy and believe each day. The reason why this is on my mind a little bit, and this may be a somewhat of a rough transition, but it's in my heart, you'll understand why I say that in a moment, to talk to you a little bit more about Bronson's announcement with Mr. Smitty. Mr. Smitty is a member of our fellowship, and he's dying. Let's not kid ourselves. Mr. Smitty is dying. He's a young man. The last time I laid eyes on him, he was robust of health, a man of good size. his wife, Vivian, I believe her name is, three children. One I remember the most, not that I don't remember the others, but a little boy named Ethan. And this man has dealt with cancer now for some time. And I got to thinking about that. You want to talk about drawing into life's two pockets. We could talk about being this way and that way. In the conversation that I had with him this past week on the phone, his heart jolted me. In talking with him about his health and his well-being and the promises of God, he was not arrogant. He wasn't focused on himself and his works. There was actually a cheerfulness in his voice, which I was caught off guard a little bit. Because, you know, sometimes when we get so ill, we're just all focused on ourselves. And I asked him in chatting with him, and first of all, I was chatting with his wife, and his health has deteriorated to the point now that he's only able to get around with a cane. He's not able to walk quite like he used to, so he has a cane. And his wife said, well, I don't know if James will be able to chat with you, but I'll let him know that you're on the line. And all of a sudden, through the phone, I could hear that cane rumbling down that hall, you know, coming through the house there. And here he came. And he came at his own pace, and that's just as it should be. When he got on the phone, he just wanted to let us all know, as members of the church, how much he appreciated all the letters, all the cards, and all the prayers. And he felt that his life, to this point, had served a tremendous witness. And he didn't understand all the whys and why nots and all the unanswered things that he's asked for and they haven't happened. But he was just content to accept God's blessing in his life. And he considered everything that happened to this point to be a blessing. And after I hung up and talking with him, I wondered, what kind of a man did I talk to today? And I realized that I had talked to a man of a good heart and a solid spirit. And he was anxiously waiting for the return of Jesus Christ. But I want you to know, he has not given up hope. He is still anxious that, as we said, you can wake up tomorrow morning and you'll be completely healed. And he says, I know that. He says, I do know that. And he says, but would you please tell all of my family, our church family, how much I appreciate their cards and their prayers and their thoughts. That's a pretty good heart, don't you think? It's a pretty good heart. There's a verse Benny and I quoted quite a bit. And we see it a lot. Old Jeremiah 17:9. You know that one? That old heart of ours is desperately wicked. No man can know it. You know, we can get misdirected pretty easily. You know, we can look back at Luke 18 and the story of the Pharisee and the publican, and we can miss the real point of what it's all about as we look at these two extremes, as we look at these two options, these two pockets in life that we draw out of. I've gotten to think about the casualty it is to mishandle our human hearts, and that was prompted to a great degree by my conversation with Mr. Smitty the other evening. He has chosen to reach into the pocket of, I am unworthy of God's greatest blessing to be in his kingdom, but I am so anxious to receive that blessing. He didn't talk about any of his works. He didn't talk about what could have been. There was no anger, no hostility. It was just a simple, resigned acceptance of God's will. A story caught my attention. It's quite a metaphor for what we can accidentally do in ourselves. It involves a lady by the name of Wanda Corden. She was a nurse, and this was on the Associated Press wire. Of all things, being a nurse, she was involved in carrying a heart to a patient for a transplant. And along the way, she accidentally dropped a human heart. She dropped it, apparently, on the ground where it was contaminated. Well, you can imagine what she thought. Well, like most of us, when we make a mistake, we just begin to cover up things. Well, so she did the very same thing. She took this human heart and she threw it in the trash because she assumed that it couldn't be used once it had been contaminated. And to cover herself, she falsified records, but guess what? She was found out. And she was reprimanded, and she was fined $250. Do you know what the formal charge was? And this is what caught my attention. The formal charge was, quote, inappropriate handling of a human heart. Inappropriate handling of a human heart. What a metaphor. Think about that. When I read here in Luke chapter 18, I also, with taking a little bit of license, I see the inappropriate handling of the human heart. And that's a terrible loss, and it's a terrible casualty, and it's something we do not want to be involved with at all. I might ask you to turn here quickly now to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15 and verse 18. I thought it would be appropriate, since I was talking about this to you, and considering these two extremes, the Pharisee and the publican, to talk to you about what it is that defiles us, that contaminates us. It says here, Matthew chapter 15 and verse 18, but those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile the man. Then it goes on to tell us about some of these things. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts. You know, lots of people have evil thoughts today. You just watch television or watch movies or listen to kids talk. I'll tell you what, evil is alive and well. And we talk about the devil is alive and well. Well, yes, he is, but so is his tool of evil. Evil thoughts, where we assign all sorts of motive to this and that and the other thing, and it may or may not be true, and you're struggling with somebody in your family, and you know, who knows? We just begin to think evil when there is no evil. Goes on to talk about murders and adulteries and fornications and thefts and false witnesses and blasphemies. Verse 20 says, these are the things that do what? They defile a man. These are the things that do it. It is not, then verse 20, which is what these verses were all about, it is not what you put in, this little bit of dirt that you may have on your hands that you didn't wash. That's not what defiles you at all. Now, Luke 18, the story of the publican says, verse 13, and the publican standing afar off would not so much lift up his eyes into heaven, but smote upon his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me. And verse 14 is the key verse. It says, I tell you, this is Jesus summarizing for us, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. This man. So Jesus shows us which one is the example to follow, doesn't he? Which pocket we are to thrive out of each day, if you go back to my earlier statement. The two directions in life. Oh, look how great I am. And, you know, that's different than how blessed you have been. There's a big difference. And then it's just unbelievable the gift of eternal life that's awaiting me as a child of God, which is what Mr. Smitty's attitude was. It's just overwhelming. For everyone, in verse 14, that exalts himself shall be abased. In other words, if you have that persistent attitude that's represented there in the example of the Pharisee, you are going to be brought down because you have a corrupted heart. But he that humbles himself, you shall be exalted. Maybe it's best said in Deuteronomy chapter 6 now, if you turn back there. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 5. Verse 4 we'll read, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. He is one Lord. And you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart. I mentioned some days everything goes right. And then some days everything goes wrong. if things are going wrong, then you need to lay aside your corrupted heart and get right with God. That's pretty strong talk. But God hasn't called us into a life of Christianity where everything is supposed to go wrong. No, rather he has called us into a life where we wake up and everything at the day's end has gone just fine, because we have had God's blessing and he has been with us. So I want you to think about Mr. Smitty, a member of our fellowship who is facing the most serious events of life, which are life and death. I want you to think about yourself, the two pockets of life. I want you to think about the way that you are in light of what we read in Luke chapter 18, the example of the Pharisee and the publican. And don't you be like that butter-fingered nurse and get charged with inappropriate handling of your human heart.